Welcome back to the Rhetoric Warriors podcast, where we are teaching the world some rhetorical defense systems. It's like the Star Wars defense systems. We're just shooting down unethical rhetoric from the skies. Complicated times require sophisticated techniques, so you might as well get some. I'm Dr. Dan, rhetoric PhD, escaped professor, stand-up late-night comedy writer from Hollywood, founder of Rhetoric Warriors. I'm spreading some education out in the world, trying to do some mental rearrangement, or I don't know, just give some people some of the stuff that I learned way back when. The podcast, I talk to comedians. We do three things. I talk to comedians about their careers in politics, because that's usually fun. I convert conservatives because they worry me and I think they need some talking to. So that's interesting. And I talk to people who are actively in the field doing some form of persuasion pros, social issue activists, politicians, and of course, more rhetoricians on this podcast than any other podcast in the world. That's an unverified claim, and I'm staying with it. So this week is another episode of the Rhetorician Files. My guest this week is a rhetoric professor at Texas A&M, a place I know well. I used to be married to one of those people. She is the author of Demagogue for President, The Rhetorical Genius of Donald Trump. And she's got a 25-page vita, so I've got plenty of things I could talk to her about. Welcome, Jennifer Merchia.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
I got that right, Merchia.
You totally got it right.
Wow, that's...
Cha-cha-cha-chia.
I'm from Kentucky, so that's almost a miracle that I got that right. I mispronounce everything. So, Texas A&M, you've been there a while, huh?
Yes, my only academic appointment. I have been here since 2003.
Wow, that's a run.
Yeah, it might be my only one. They just promoted me to full professor, so I probably won't leave.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's the golden quicksand, right?
Not quite gold, but
yeah.
Yes,
I was a professor off and on. Like, I had two full time appointments at Cal State Fullerton and a little college called Peace College in Raleigh, North Carolina. But I was never really an academic scholar. I liked the intellectual side of it, but that kind of writing, my brain just balks.
Yeah. It's kind of like a bait and switch because grad school is so much fun. You get to, you know, read books that you're interested in and sit around a table and talk to people about it. It's like a, you know, perpetual reading group or whatever. And then, yeah, you have to go get a job eventually. And that's not as fun.
It's not. I have a friend, what's his name? William something. Anyway, he's a rhetorician and we talked for a while at the University of Louisville together. And we were walking around one of the neighborhoods and they have all these beautiful brownstones in these neighborhoods there. And I'm like, you know, just look at this block. If every house on this, just this block had somebody cool that you knew living in it, you know, like another professor or they did this or whatever, you'd never have to go anywhere. Your life would be completely full, but it never works out that way.
That's right. We live not far from campus and we feel like our street's kind of like that. And I'm sure it's like that in Austin, actually. You got cool people everywhere.
Yeah, but it's spread out. You know, it's like everything else. Like as the city gets more and more filled with people, it just squishes out. So you never know who's on your street. And
Yeah, we definitely know our neighbors and they're all awesome people.
Cool.
Can attest.
It sounds like you're winning. You're winning the professor game.
I'm winning today.
So tell me a little bit about your background, how you got into rhetoric and why rhetoric and.
Yeah. So originally I was a broadcasting major as an undergrad and I worked in radio and TV a little bit. I was a featured extra in a movie once.
Hey.
And I really, you know, I wanted to do news reporting. I wanted to like find out the truth and tell it to people and make the world a better place. And what I found is that I was, when I was working in radio, I was sitting in a room by myself and talking to myself and pushing a button every 4 minutes, which wasn't—
Welcome to big time media.
Yeah, it wasn't that. It wasn't great. And then when I was working in Sacramento at a major, you know, network affiliate, and, you know, we were rewriting video news releases and, you know, rewriting the morning local newspaper stories. And, you know, it was just about taking press releases and, you know, creating news stories out of them. And it wasn't what I had hoped it would be. And I'm pretty idealistic. So I decided not to do that. And so I decided to get a master's, and I thought I'll study political communication. And maybe I'll go work on political campaigns. Maybe I'll be a speech teacher because I had gone to community college and had been on the speech team there, and then where I ended up transferring to. And so that was a big part of my life then. And I worked on some political campaigns in California. And the first one was cool. We raised the minimum wage. And I thought that was, you know, important. And then the second one was—
you lowered the minimum wage.
Yeah, we didn't do that, but it was, I mean, I'm not a sports person, but it was about a sports stadium, you know, and so it was a big referendum to get a bunch of money to build, I think it was Candlestick Park, to build a new Candlestick Park. And the argument was so bad. It was like, the Bay is rising. And because the Bay is rising, the grass is not, you know, draining on the field. And this is a danger for our players. Now, we have just switched from artificial turf to natural grass. And so what we need to do is have, you know, some ridiculous amount of money, $100 million or something, to build a new stadium in the parking lot of the old stadium.
Oh.
Because the Bay isn't rising there. And it was so bad, and it won, and, you know, whatever, people probably were going to vote for it anyway, but it was so embarrassing to have to make those bad arguments that I decided I might try to get a PhD and stay in school and not work on political campaigns. And so then I did that, and I became very interested in studying democracy. And so my interest in rhetoric is really an interest in democracy, which is sort of, you know, explains why I wanted to write a book about demagogues and demagoguery and Donald Trump, because it's anti-democratic. And it sort of has led into my current project, which is about propaganda and ubiquitous propaganda, why we've all learned to communicate as propagandists primarily instead of as citizens. And why that's anti-democratic.
So. Yeah, there seems to be plenty for you to study about this topic.
There's a lot for that.
You know, it's fascinating to me. Like I said, I am an escape professor. I was never really politics. I did more of the rhetoric of entertainment, and I studied films and pop culture, and eventually ended up teaching screenwriting and being a TV writer, because that sort of story is what interests me. But when Trump came along and appeared on the scene like a rhetorical Viking, you know, with just slashing and breaking everything, and the entire political scene having no idea what to do with essentially just a reality show entertainer. I mean, that's all reality show narrative is just cause problems that are fast, that end, and everybody can go on to the next thing when you cause another problem. But they had no, like, that entertainment rhetoric crashing into politics, zero defenses over here. They did not know what to do, and they still don't know what to do.
That's exactly right. That's a great analysis of it. One of the things that I write in the conclusion of my book is that, you know, Trump is like P.T. Barnum in being able to attract our attention. And one of the, actually, you might know him because he's from Austin, or he was at Austin for a while, Jonathan Tylop, who who used to be the head political writer for the Austin Statesman, who just retired. He wrote a blurb for the back, and he uses the phrase that I describe Trump as an authoritarian P.T. Barnum. Mm-hmm. And that's what your description reminded me of. I would love to take credit for that phrase, but I didn't write that. But I use it all the time. Trump is absolutely an authoritarian P.T. Barnum.
Yeah, that's a
he's
nice
so good at it. And you're absolutely right. The media didn't know, the press did not know, and still does not know how to handle that. He broke the media. That's what Jay Rosen said, his goal was. And absolutely.
Yeah, and I think the promoter thing, I wrote a series of blog posts that I ended up pulling down so I can kind of collect it as a book. But the things that Trump did, his rhetorical techniques sort of across the board, like if you look at his history and his training, he's just importing his training and like his promoter training from business, you know, the fact that he was a self-promoter. And if you go back and listen to some of his early business interviews, they're exactly the same as what he was doing as president. You know, overclaims, bombast, attack the interviewer, allow no space and no air in the room. Very promoter-like techniques that I've seen forever from entertainment types who are, you know, again, like P.T. Barnum, blowing everything up so big that maybe it can raise up above all the other stories and get some notice.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Trump is not a good businessman, but he is a good marketer. And he marketed himself, his brand, and, you know, the Make America Great Again ideology very successfully. And, you know, one of the stories that I tell in that book is about the Trump University scam and how it worked. And in doing that research, I was able to read the Trump University manuals, playbooks. And they were very similar to the things that I was writing about, you know, in terms of Trump's rhetorical strategies. You mentioned using hyperbole, attacking the interviewer, all that kind of stuff. But, you know, other things too, like one of the things that they suggested is that you use like I noticed about you, right? So like that you're paying so much attention to you, the potential, stooge basically of the scam, I noticed that you were really nodding and paying attention. I noticed that, that you're taking notes. I can tell you're going to really be a success here at Trump University, all of this kind of stuff. And, it's just another ad populum appeal, right? Praising the wisdom of the crowd, in order to sort of seduce them into your trap.
Right.
Yeah.
What do you think about the viability of, rhetoric has this 2,500 year tradition. And especially when you talk about democratic tradition and rhetoric, it gives you a certain language to work with, a certain terminology apparatus. And I've been interviewing David Payne, who was my dissertation director years and years ago, quite a bit on the Rhetorician Files. And we've talked about some of the terminological apparatus and the prison house of language type stuff. That does rhetoric have enough in it to be imported over and still keep that tradition of like the democratic talk? Like he was talking about de Tocqueville and sort of all that sort of democratic rhetoric that we've inherited, kind of, nobody's learning it anymore, but is it too archaic to handle like this postmodern, Trump mixing all these different worlds together? Like, what
yeah.
do you think?
I got a lot of thoughts on that. I think it depends on how that language or that education is deployed, like anything. Academic language isn't going to help anybody do anything in the public sphere.
You published.
Yeah, but no one will read it, right? Yeah. Like, you can publish in academic journals and such, but it's never going to be read by the public. And the language that's used is so obtuse and specialized that, it's not designed for the public. And so that's something that I actually really try to fight against in my research. So this book, this Trump book, was published with an academic press, but it's not written for academics and it's not written that way. And so every time I use an academic term, even though, you know, the reader has seen it, you know, 50 times at this point and certainly knows the definition, I still put in parentheses the like common sense words, you know, for what right. It is. So, you know, one of the things that I write about is the way that Trump uses paralepsis, which is an ancient rhetorical term that means, you know, to leave to the side. And so the modern way of understanding it is, I'm not saying, I'm just saying. Right. And so everybody loves that. Everybody loves, I'm not saying, I'm just saying. They're interested in how that works, you know, how irony works, how it allows you to say two things at once, how, you know, you can't hold someone accountable because they're not really saying the thing that they're saying, how it provides, you know, a backstage view where you think you know what the person really thinks because they're telling you, you know, the secret, god awful truth that they wouldn't say and they know they shouldn't say. And aren't they really a truth teller for saying it, you know? And aren't they a hero? You know, there's a lot there. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of ways that you know, can amplify conspiracy theory and all of that. All of those stories are so fascinating. And people are interested in it. But, you know, if I was to publish an academic article on paralepsis, no one's going to care. And it's not going to reach the audience that, you know, I would like to reach, which is regular folks who are interested and care.
So. Yeah. And that's my same project with Rhetoric Warriors.
Yeah, like how do you
harvest from this massive trove of work, even academics in the last 20 years, just the amount of papers and studies and books and lectures and conversations. It's just inestimable, inestimable. Cannot be estimated.
Cannot.
How do you go in and pull something like paralepsis, which is this tiny little rhetoric technique floating around in that world, and go, hey, look how cool this is, and make that actionable and useful for people?
Yeah. So I'll tell you that. So I originally got into the Trump business, or the Trump criticism business, I should say, because of the New York Times. In November of 2015, they were doing an analysis of his language. They wanted me to participate in sort of a week-long project with them where I would watch his rally, you know, speeches and his interviews and look at his tweets and such, and then let them know if I saw any evidence of demagoguery, and if so, you know, what I saw. And so I did that. And in watching him over that week, I saw him repeatedly do, you know, six things. And so I had the interview and I told them, you know, the six rhetorical strategies, the ancient Greek and the Latin things and why he used them and how it worked and what he was doing. And, you know, at the end, they included a couple of quotations from me, but they didn't, you know, they didn't focus on my terms. They had their own sort of framework for understanding him. And, you know, I don't think any of them got, you know, none of the rhetoric terms got into the thing. And that ended up being my book, right? Like those six terms are the things that I saw him repeatedly do over the course of the campaign. And I got a chance to explain it to people. But yeah, I mean, you know, initially there was some interest, but really there wasn't, you know, right. There wasn't interest in explaining the rhetorical strategies or using the terms. And so I was really excited that I got to do that. You know, for the book, but, yeah, I mean, that's what I want to do. I want to help people to see what we can see. You know, when you look at Trump for a week, you're going to see the same things that I'm going to see because we have similar training. But most people can't see that, you know, they can hear, I'm not saying, I'm just saying, or, you know, praising the wisdom of the crowd or whatever. But they don't know the terms. They don't know why it's meaningful. They don't know the research, you know, that
right.
explains it all. So I don't know. It's cool to be able to do that, to translate it.
Yeah. And I find people do have a fascination with it. There's a gap, cavern, chasm, between their fast.
Laucuna. Huh? A laucuna.
Oh, that's a, what's that word?
It means a gap chasm.
In Maltese or?
No, laucuna. No? Look it up.
Okay, I've never heard of it.
I try to sneak it into all of my work. It's one of my favorite words.
How do you spell it?
Laucuna. Maybe it's not A-U.
L-A. All right, I'll find it. So over here, you've got the fascination. You know, you can hook people with this stuff. I've made a living in the last 5 years in marketing and business. I never worked for business until I moved back to Austin to raise my kids, and I couldn't work in entertainment anymore. And I couldn't take education, academics anymore. So I pivoted and started selling consulting and marketing to business. And you can hook people with, like, even tell them, like, I have all sorts of lures. I was going to name my consulting business Lure Incorporated. Like, I can lure you in, like, just telling you that there are dark arts of rhetoric that are being used out there. And Trump knows them. And he's using them on you. And unless you learn the white arts of rhetoric to counter them, you're going to lose. And so you can get people fascinated with it. The lacuna in between that and getting them to learn the rhetoric so that they can use it is vast. Like people check out so quickly because it's really hard to consumptionize rhetoric as an information source. It's a pretty complicated tool.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and maybe Trump and, you know, the rise of authoritarianism, you know, maybe that will motivate people to want to study it more. Maybe not. But he is, you know, just a little. He's such a good example of, you know, why we should study rhetoric, you know, to protect ourselves from people who use language to deceive us and to manipulate. And who are really good at it. You know, I mean, if you talk to a political scientist, or at least if you did talk to one before Donald Trump became president, about, you know, the possibility of a demagogue running for president in the United States, they would say it's impossible, right? They would say that the system is designed to prevent that, you know, that the constitutional apparatus, that the party system, the party apparatus, you know, that the media would provide a check on any potential demagogue and winnow them out, right? And like you said, Trump broke all of that. You know, he broke all of those barriers. No one was able to hold him accountable or prevent him from taking power. And, you know, if you turn to a rhetorician, they would say that that's always the danger, right? That's why we study rhetoric. Is so that we can understand how these strategies work and how someone like Donald Trump can be a demagogue, can be an unaccountable leader using language successfully to do that. And, you know, that's a blind spot that they would have had that we didn't have. But
yeah, and it's fascinating with Trump, the collision of Trump, which his techniques are not hard to lay out. You can see them. They're very simple. He's very simple in what he does. But the collision with that, with the rise of digital social, the phenomenon of being able to directly deliver those messages to people with no filter, no gatekeeper, you know, in this 3 feet space is incredible. Like when they turned him off Twitter, it felt like the entire country fell silent. Like, oh my God, all the loudspeakers that have been blaring are gone.
Yeah, absolutely. He took up a lot of space, you know, in the public sphere. And so that's one of the things that I try to explain is that he used language to attack the nation by attacking our public sphere. And it, you know, my work on demagoguery sort of merged with another strand of research that I do, which is on the rhetorical presidency and presidential rhetoric. And Trump
was
not
hard for you.
Exactly. Yeah. I told you he's been a mentor for me. You know, Trump was never a president. He was always a demagogue. And he never used presidential rhetoric. He used demagoguery. And he said, you know, that he didn't want to be presidential. He thought being presidential was boring.
Sure. And he's right. In the entertainment sphere, it's boring.
Yeah. It's
like,
boring.
Unless you're going to put it clear and present danger, put it on Air Force One with terrorists coming after him, by definition, in the entertainment world, it's boring.
Yeah. And Biden is boring. You know, he wants to be boring. You know, yeah. Biden was a gaffe machine. Like, he still is. And if he talked more, we would be, you know, outraged maybe by all of his mistakes that he would make. But he's just like, zip it. I'm going to be presidential.
The discipline he showed, like, even when Trump, you know, in that second to the last debate, or did it turn out to be the last debate, I guess, was just pushing his buttons. And the worst thing he said was, you know, shut this clown down. Like, yeah. Clown was the worst they got out of him. That's pretty good. That's pretty good discipline.
It is. But so it's actually fascinating that Trump's been deplatformed in terms of the rhetorical presidency and the history between the press and the president, because what it means is that Donald Trump has less rhetorical power as an ex-president than any president since William Howard Taft, right? Because what happened is the rhetorical presidency emerges with Woodrow Wilson, and he's the first president to really use communication, communicating directly to the people.
Wasn't he Mr. White Supremacist? Didn't he reframe the KKK and everything else?
Yeah, yeah, he did that. And he also—
Thanks, Woodrow.
He also rewrote the Constitution by going over the heads of Congress and speaking directly to the people. Primarily before that, the president used intra-governmental communication. Most of the speeches of the president were, you know, to other bodies of government. And Congress was supposed to be the sort of forefront of the national political imagination. And so Wilson changed that by using new media at the time. So radio, phonographic records, that kind of thing, to speak directly to the people, to get the people to put pressure on Congress to enact Wilson's agenda. And that recentered our view of government to the presidency. And from Wilson to about George W. Bush, you had this essentially cooperative relationship between the press and the president, where the president gave the press access and information, and the press provided a platform to connect their rhetoric, their policies to the people. With the emergence of new media around George W. Bush's presidency, the press became obsolete, right? Because we no longer needed, the president no longer needed the press to be able to communicate directly to their supporters and to the people as a whole. And so what you saw with Donald Trump is really a continuation of something that George W. Bush did, that Barack Obama did, which is to say that he went over the heads of Congress and he went around the news filter to use social media to speak directly to his supporters. And he was very effective at it.
Yeah, the good things, if you look at, to me, like why Trump was successful, again, I tend to harvest from my experience in Hollywood and entertainment,
sure,
like how they work things and how the production apparatus works there. And then once I got into marketing and promotion, I could see that as well. And I knew a lot of stuff from live event stand-up promoters too. But when you look at what Trump does, when you give him any like tiny opening, he just maximizes it.
Yeah.
And I don't think presidents, and I don't think politicians have been used to that type of maximization of every opportunity. To make sure you get emotion in it, to make sure you get conflict in it. Doesn't matter who it is. Every day has to have a new conflict in order to make it entertaining, which is, you know, the core of most entertainment narrativity is conflict. Yeah. And it doesn't matter whether it's true or nice or anything else. It's just, is it there? And so using that with that open platforming that you're talking about, yeah, it's a double barrel shotgun at that point.
Yeah, he took advantage of, you know, the attention economy, and he took advantage of outrage, right, which drives attention. And he used attention and outrage to control the public sphere and to win the presidency. Nobody who has, you know, rhetorical training or who studies democratic stability or, you know, democratic deliberation or the public sphere, anything like that, would say that, you know, political discourse should be organized around attention and outrage.
Right.
Right. Like, those are not productive values for any of that. But that wasn't Donald Trump's agenda, right? He didn't care about democratic stability or democratic backsliding or erosion or, you know, productive public discourse or problem solving, right, or any of that. He cared about keeping our attention, and he was great at it, unfortunately.
Well, and that again is my thing about the traditions of rhetoric. In some ways, I think have held us back. Like, we didn't believe like Trump could be done. And Trump is a once in a lifetime character. The culture knew him for 40 years before he ran for president. He had so much saturation. And then he got on, you know, The Apprentice, and they turned him into a hero, glorified him in front of everybody for 10 years, number one show on TV. That amount of exposure, nobody else has that. Like, who else is going to do that, especially on the nefarious side, like Trump, the anti-hero? Who else has that could do it? I mean, now you're starting to like look around to harvest, like from the Tom Hanks and maybe The Rock, Matthew McConaughey talking about running for governor, you know, all these different things, but none of them are Trump.
Right. None of them are Trump. You know, I've seen some people write that Tucker Carlson seems to occupy the same media space that Trump did. He's been very successful at agitating people in the mainstream media and on the left. You know, and so there's that, but I don't think Tucker Carlson is.
Yeah, but where's he been a hero?
Exactly. Yeah. He's not exactly Trump.
Yeah. He's so mealy.
Fish sticks.
That kind of, yeah, I think you can make people, even people like him, I think you can make them skin crawl about him with his little bow tie and that kind of stuff. So do you take the next step, which, you know, there's documenting the unethical techniques of demagogues and propagandists. Do you offer counters?
No, I don't. A lot of people asked me to do that. I was really nervous as I was writing this book about being accused of being political, right?
How dare you?
I know. Well, you know, I am an academic and it's an academic book, and people are very excited about attacking academics these days.
What?
So yes, it's
true.
You
mean like since Reagan attacked all of academics, people are like, academics?
Crazy. Well, you know, there are really organized campaigns about this. And so I was a little bit chicken, I have to admit.
Sure.
But also, I convinced myself that it would be more democratic for me to point it out so that people could see what I see, make an argument, you know, for why this is dangerous for democracy, and then, you know, invite people to decide for themselves what they think they should do about it. Because, you know, that sort of crossing the line into advocacy, I think, is where, you know, where I don't know, was like a bridge too far or something for me. And also I wasn't really sure I had answers for how to stop Trump, you know? And so, yeah, so I tried to, you know, just sort of use democracy as my decision rule. And, you know, the last chapter in my book is about Trump using authoritarianism to appeal to his voters and his supporters and why that worked for him. And, you know, the stuff that we've been seeing from polls about Trump supporters and, you know, whether they prefer a strong leader, authoritarianism, or whether they prefer democracy, how, you know, committed they are to democratic values and democracy as a political system. You know, they're not.
No, absolutely not.
They're really not. And so, you know, I think democracy is something we have to fight for. And I hope people understand that.
So again, from my entertainment and creative side, creative comics always try to take what is and see if they can alter it to maybe what they want it to be, or at least whatever creative thing it could be. So democracy, you have this huge tradition of democracy, but it kind of got broken right from Gingrich and the obstructionists in Congress. And here, let's make sure government doesn't work. And now let's yell at everybody that government doesn't work. So they hate government, and therefore government doesn't work. Like, we've broken it. And do we need like some kind of democracy 2.0? Like, it doesn't seem to be functioning in the modern digital environment very well.
Yeah, we do. We definitely do. And we needed it before Gingrich. You know, he exploited norms in the same way that Trump exploits norms. And he broke, you know, the consensus system in Washington. But so my first book is called Founding Fictions, and it's a history of the first two generations of Americans and how they argued over what kind of government they were going to have. You know, if it's a government based on the will of the people, what's that called? And what can the people do? You know, points of stasis, right? What can the people do in a government based on the will of the people? And it's called Founding Fictions, right? So it's really about why we think we have a democracy when we don't, and how the founders were afraid of the people and, right, you know, their dangerous opinions, and how they wanted to separate the government from the people as much as they possibly could.
Well, that was the rise of the Senate, right? The powerful Senate and all that kind of stuff about the republicanism within, yeah, a democracy.
Basically. Yeah, every part of the Constitution is about protecting the government from the people, and also protecting the government from, you know, a demagogue on one hand, or a king, or a cabal, right? Like, they were terrified of power, of people having political power and using it improperly, but including the people, average citizens. And, you know, so, like, a lot of people understand now that the Constitution was, you know, profoundly anti-democratic because of slavery, and all of the, you know, parts of the system that it had to accommodate that. But it was also always going to be profoundly anti-democratic. So I wrote about that, I guess in 2010, that book came out. You know, that's never changed, right? So, you know, the last part of that book is I explain how Andrew Jackson, you know, with the rise of democracy in America, you know, sort of reimagined the term democracy so that it became, you know, something that people found more acceptable, but he did nothing to change the system of government that was always anti-democratic, you know, so that it was always a legerdemain, it was always a sleight of hand, that we called our government a democracy when it wasn't. So
good for us. We're so good at using rhetoric. Look at us. We need some cover here to not have a democracy. I know, let's call it a democracy.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And so, you know, what Jackson did was that he changed, he turned citizens into partisans, basically, and then called partisanship democracy.
Interesting. So, you know,
still
this idea of history that you're using to draw context to the present, is that what you're doing?
I do that.
Yeah. Like an academic turn there, little game that you're playing of, oh, we can learn right now by looking at how this evolved. Yeah. Again, how do you sell that to people? Like, in the consumption culture and information is what I'm fighting right now or figuring out, right? Like, even doing a podcast, I find fascinating the amount of information I can get into an hour of animated conversation. And I love, you know, like, conversation as learning, because it's easier to me. It's more dynamic. There's more, yeah, going on. I mean, it doesn't allow you to deep dive into the, you know, hold on to the details and all that kind of stuff, because you just went through a huge area of, you know, American history of Andrew Jackson, and you pulled out a nice conclusion from it, which I think people could clearly learn from. And they'll be out there going, who's Andrew Jackson? What?
Andy Jack.
Andy Jack. A-Jack. That guy. The original Trump. All those pictures of the store, or the paintings, I guess, of his people, you know, raising the White House, the original, you know, horde in the White House. Pretty cool.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and Trump had a picture, a portrait of Jackson on the wall in the Oval Office. He loves Jackson.
He went to a little stage where he was trying to appropriate that guy and imprint him on himself.
And then he decided he was Lincoln.
Yeah. Well, he's better, you know, he's better to all minorities than even Lincoln. That's the fascinating thing about Trump. I think when people really understand how unhinged you can make rhetoric and talk from truth, like in the past, you only had, I think politicians only had so much leeway. Like if they went a little too far, everybody's like, hey, hey, you're lying. He just shattered, you know, those connections.
Yeah.
And when you get into that kind of, I don't know how much postmodern stuff you do, but like I start with, because I find it a very useful thing if I can get it a little bit into people's heads when I do the converting conservatives with smart people. I'm like very well-educated people and try to think their way through it. I'm like, well, you're thinking in the simulacrum.
Yeah.
And they're like, what does that mean? I'm like, it means there's something, here's the world over here and here's you, and there's something always between you. And it wants to craft that experience, and it's called the simulation.
Yeah.
You're like, what? But it's one of those, at least mind chiselers, like you can get it in there and pry people and stop them at least a little bit. And then you got to take them slowly through it, but it does at least get you to where they can have some meta perspective, which is where people like you can come into the breach and go, hey, now that you're thinking a little bit.
Yeah. 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 I mean, so one thing that I did as I was writing my book, is that I, cause you know, writing is lonely, right? Doing your academic stuff is.
I do it at parties. Like I invite people over and I just sit in the corner and write.
Yeah. Well, so I would just do these threads, you know, like I'm writing a section on this and, you know, this is where I'm at and here are a bunch of links and, you know, kind of think out loud, and write it in public. And I found that was really a great strategy for me, because it attracted people to what I was doing. People had lots of great suggestions for, you know, things that I didn't know or, you know, hadn't read or, you know, whatever. And it made them sort of invested in, you know, the outcome, like they wanted to read the book when it came out. And one way, and this is, I swear, going to connect back to Baudrillard, is that I was, writing a thread about Trump and the spectacle. And I took a bunch of stuff that I had cut from the conclusion of the book, because it was just, my book was way too long. And and so many people like found the thread useful and engaged with it and, you know, really interacted with the ideas of it, that I was like, well, but I cut this from my book, and they were like, no, put it back in. And so I did, you know, I put it back in my book because, you know, Twitter told me to. And yeah, I mean, that's exactly right. Right. Like people want that, like they didn't know about the Society of the Spectacle and Guy Debord, and they didn't know about, you know, what is true is what can sell, like the commodification of information in the way that the spectacle sells reality. You know, they didn't know about Baudrillard, you know, even if they've seen The Matrix, you know, where Baudrillard was popularized a lot, you know, at that time when The Matrix came out. You know, they didn't know that stuff, and they certainly hadn't connected it to Trump, you know, the way that you and I would. Right. And you know, so what was obvious to me and was something that could clearly be cut was to them, like, you know, eye-opening. And so, yeah, I put that back in.
You know, I spent the whole time I was going through academics, I was also running a stand-up career on the weekends and vacations and whenever I could. And so I learned, like, stand-up teaches you a ton about writing and creativity and information and audience and that kind of stuff. And it's such a close feedback loop. Like, you can literally think of something that day and you're the whole production system. You're the director, the writer, the performer, the producer, all of it. And then you go up that night and do it for a real audience. And they tell you with incredible clarity, hey, that's good. That's terrible. And so you end up writing in a real feedback loop with the audience, as opposed to, like, most writing and authorship, which is you imagining this audience that's going to get to at some point. And maybe you've got some readers here and there, but they're all giving you different perspectives. The audience in stand-up will give you a very cohesive, big response. And it's merciless.
That sounds frightening, but also really helpful and useful. You know, one of the things, so Jay Rosen is a professor at NYU who has a blog called Press Think, and he's probably the nation's foremost critic of journalism and journalistic practice. And I mentioned him earlier when I said that, you know, Trump's goal was to break the press. That's something that he said in 2016. And so he has a whole bunch of recommendations for how to rebuild trust between journalism and audiences. And one of the things that he says is, you know, crowdsourcing, you know, what topic should I cover? You know, what is interesting to you? Like, what do you want me to ask this elected official? Like investigative practices that really involve the audience, writing in public, that kind of thing, so that people can see, you know, the backstage, can see the process, and then learn to trust the process, which is also similar to what, you know, someone like Robert Putnam, who wrote the book Bowling Alone, you know, what he writes about the failure of public trust in the United States. You know, he says, one of the things that he says is that it's partially due to the fact that we've withdrawn from, you know, the public decision making. And right. So we could trust the decision of the PTA or of the, you know, of the local city council, because we participated in that. And so we saw what the process was like. And when we stopped doing that, you know, these decisions would just emerge and we wouldn't know why or, you know, how they were decided. And because of that, we lost a lot of trust in the process and in the body, the deliberative body itself. You know, I kind of selfishly did this when I was writing my book, just because I was lonely and I had a lot of, you know, I had all this stuff, you know, I would be just intaking information and trying to organize it. And so, you know, I found that making threads would help me to say very succinctly what I was thinking, you know, and organize my thoughts in a way that, you know, I could then go back to later and be like, what was I thinking? How was I going to write that? But it really did turn out to be a really good engagement strategy for writing the book, you know, in building trust with an audience too.
So talk a little bit about your new book, The Propagandist, that we are all propagandists. Is that the... we've swallowed so much of it. It's like lead in the water. We don't even notice it anymore.
Yeah. I'm going to write that. So it's tentatively titled We the Propagandists. So like we the people. And it kind of picks up from that discussion that I was having with you earlier about Andrew Jackson turning us, you know, from citizens into partisans. When I talked about that book in that research for a long time, people would say, you know, and what are we today? And I'd be like, yeah, we're partisans still, you know, we haven't changed. But I think we have now that when I got started writing, really writing the Trump book, I really got fascinated by propaganda and I wanted to include more of that in the book, but I needed to stick to my 6 rhetorical terms. Because it was way too long. And so I've been teaching a class on propaganda and thinking about how to write this book, which I'm now working on. And Yeah, what I think happened is, again, you know, adding another layer of separation between the people and their dangerous opinions and democracy, like actual democracy, and, you know, the way that people had new political power with social media and the ability to communicate. You know, we had broadcast power all of a sudden, in a way that we never had prior to social media. And I think that what ended up happening is that we got turned into propagandists instead of using that political power to advance the cause of democracy. So all of the arguments that people made, you know, at the beginning of the web about how it's going to be this democratic force, had this potential anyway to be this democratic force, you know, that knowledge and information were going to be widespread and easily available. I think that what happened is that once again, they figured out a way to prevent us from using that power that we could have had for democracy, and instead channeled all of our democratic impulses into becoming propagandists.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
It's a happy story.
Well, think about it, though. This is the nature of democracy, uncontrolled participation. And so you have a public discourse, and I start a lot of my stuff sometimes with, think of the idea of the public discourse as a stream. Like, it's literally a mountain stream, and it's pure and silver and nothing bad in there. And then you tell, you know, 300 million people, you can put anything you want into that stream. And just, what do you expect to happen? You still do have those things. You have great people in the public discourse stream who are giving out great information and free and awesome and insightful. And there's plenty there, plenty. But you also have all the misinformationists, all the propagandists, all the nefarious people who want to ruin that stream for their own purposes. And we don't protect that stream at all. It's not like we have a rhetorical guardian of the galaxy tribe out there like, hey, keep that out of the stream because it's dangerous. And everybody retreats back to this self-determination, this market, you know, ideology of, hey, you know what, we don't control speech around here. I'm like, well, once you open up a whole new access to the stream, guess what? You may need to do something different, some kind of control, because there's nothing now. And so there's no way public discourse is ever going to be pure and useful and clean. So what do? You just let the propagandists just dump all this stuff in there, and you train the people up so that they can recognize, oh, that's a tire floating down my stream. That's ugly. Or, you know, or do you do some kind of protection? What are the creative solutions to keeping that stream viable?
Yeah. There's right? there's a lot of smart people working on that. And at the same time, I think everyone who's working on it realizes that it's basically impossible. Although there are lots of ideas, and some of them seem to work a little bit.
I don't know. I got terminated off YouTube.
Oh, did you?
For this, for just interviews.
Good job.
And so I had to go back around their back doors and come in through their Twitter support team and be like, hey, I'm interviewing mostly professors about protecting the public from anti-vax and all that kind of stuff. And they're like, what?
Why would you?
I'm like, this is exactly what you want on your site. And so they finally reinstated me. But I try to make the point to them, and like, even like, go back to rhetoric, right? Like, how about ethos? Instead of trying to carve through the content, which you're never going to do, because now you're going down to terms, and they're basically terminating me, literally terminating me, because I'm interviewing somebody who's, you know, anti-vax, and taking them through a conversion process. So I'm like, you can't do that. So how about ethos? Like, maybe everybody, like, if you qualify, it's like speed pass at the airport, where you get a good stamp of approval, and then they let you post whatever you want.
Yeah. Or maybe, you know, the the protections in 230, and the internet code will get adjusted. There'd be some accountability. But, you know, I like your metaphor of this dream, and I think that it's really apt. But I think that one thing that's different today, you know, that sort of separates the new propaganda from the old propaganda, is that the platforms, the stream itself is like calling for the people to put the tires in, right? And the platforms
rewards them for it.
Are rewarding the people for putting the tires in, and addicting people to putting the tires in, and so you think you're doing the right thing because you get all the retweets and the recirculation of your content, and it juices the dopamine receptors in your brain, right? And all that. And, how would you know that's wrong if you're getting rewarded by all of the mechanisms, that are available? So it's pretty broken. it's pretty broken.
Well, it should be, right? It's a brand new medium, a brand new distribution platform. Yes. Nobody's ever dealt with this in all of human history. I explain it sometimes, like social media is like you're trying to have a fight with one person in a boxing match, but there's a million people watching and anybody can jump into the ring and hit you in the back of the head at any time. Like, who has ever had a multi-log at that level where you're in that kind of communication from that many people that instantly? It's never happened.
No. And, they give people the power to blow up the world with zero training about what's newsworthy or what is liable, or, they don't teach us the things that like journalists learn, because they're being prepared for a profession where they're going to communicate to the public about public things. They don't give people training in that when they hand them a cell phone when they're 13 years old or whatever. I'm sure you saw this story, maybe you didn't because it's ridiculous, but about this 17-year-old kid, and now I can't remember his name, who tried to invite his high school to a party for his birthday this weekend in Huntington Beach. I think it was Adrian. So, go read the New York Times today. Taylor Lorenz has a good article about this. But so the thing is that him and his buddy like made a digital flyer and they posted it on their channels. And somehow this thing got trending to such a degree that like 280 million people or something like that. That's ridiculous. It can't be that. Some ridiculous amount of people, saw this thing and it trended all week. And people were like making TikToks about how they were flying to California to attend this party. They ended up having 2 days of police action in Huntington Beach, shutting down and arresting all these 17, 18, 19-year-olds for trying to attend a party that this kid was, just trying to have with his friends from school. It's that kind of thing, like, oopsie. And so he didn't end up even showing up to his party because he was afraid that he had, he was going to get arrested for causing a riot. But he's also like acquired a manager in the meantime, sure. Like in the last few days since this thing happened, he's got some sponsorship deals. He's, palling around in the DMs with all the influencers,
But it is, right? I mean, when you look,
that's where we're at.
But Baudrillard couldn't even have seen any of this, like the pastiche experience of all of this now. The unconnectedness, the just crazy randomness of it, the flash into the air and then the precipitous fall. Like, that guy's not going to be anything in 3 months. He'll go down into this. And understanding that kind of as a culture, in a community itself, It's just bizarre. My son is 18 and he is making a living in Rocket League. I don't know if you know, it's an online multiplayer game. 40 million people play it worldwide.
Wow.
And he got to be a little celebrity in it.
Cool.
Because he's a video editor and a special effects editor, self-taught from YouTube, and started getting hired to edit all the professional players' matches down to 5 minutes. He's really good at it because he knows he's been playing this game since he was 11. And so got really popular, and a company hired him to just pay him each month to not even talk about their company really, but they can put his stuff on their website. So he's getting influencer money. He's getting, video money, and it's all in that little universe that almost nobody's heard of, even though 40 million people around the world play this.
Right.
Wow. And how do you explain that? So here we are, traditional academics who came through book literary, traditions and writing, doing lectures. Right. Come on. Like we're so dinosaurs that we're probably oil at this point.
Yeah, absolutely. How is that a job? Right? Like my dad, who worked in a car factory his whole life, he wouldn't recognize that as a job. And my brother makes video games and has done that since the 1980s. So he also doesn't understand how that's a job, even though we do. This is the thing, is that the reality of the internet and the way that it has changed, how information circulates, is amplified, becomes celebrity, all of that, it just completely messes with our ideal of reality, of work, of life, of what living is. And it's in, just to take it back to what you said about Trump earlier, and then politics. And so you have someone like Trump who's like, I'm a liar. What's truth? And he takes us to like a pre-Cartesian view, I know you know what I mean, of of what is truth, right? Where he's like, it's what I say it is. It's what I convince people to believe it is. Your facts don't matter to me. Facts.
Those are just punching bags.
And then of course there's the whole, denial of expertise that comes with that. And, of course all established leaders and academics and other kinds of experts are all corrupt. Right.
Well, they've got to cut all those out, right? If you're going to play appropriation, you're going to play masquerade, you're going to do all these, I lay it out as the unethical playbook, here are the unethical techniques that they're using, that the nefarious are using. And here's the ethical playbook. And they, they mix, but you can at least show it. You can at least show masqueradism. Like, hey, they are literally wearing a mask of somebody who they are not. And look at all the other things over here. Even with Trump, if you just lay out, business promoter. I do this with Fox News all the time. Like when I do a little bit of logic conversion on conservatives, which is not easy, but I'm like, well, Fox is not even an American company. Like it was founded by a foreign nation, with the Australian Rupert Murdoch, who got made a British citizen, and then Reagan made him an American citizen. Why would we let a foreign country create a fourth network inside of our country? If that was China or the Middle East, like if the color of that person had been wrong, would have never got in. And they're like, what do you mean? I'm like, they don't even know he's Australian, right?
Right.
So if you can get a little of their xenophobia on your side.
Use it against them.
Yeah.
I think one of the things that I have tried to talk about is the kind of Ciceronian qui bono, right? Who profits approach to debunking things, right? Which is to always sort of ask, who's winning if this happens, and who's losing. But at the same time, you know, I worry a lot about cynicism. And so, you know, the sort of fine line between critical thinking, asking who profits, and thinking that, you know, cynically, that, you know, everything is corrupt and everything, you know, tuquoque, right, which is appeal to hypocrisy. Everyone is a hypocrite. Every political figure, you know, is a liar and is on the take. And, you know, I mean, that kind of cynicism leads to Trump, you know, at the same time. And so, you know, that fine line between being hopeful and being critical, you know, it's hard to maintain both of that, you know, both of those things simultaneously.
Comedy's useful for that.
Yeah.
Because I get to do this stuff with people, like they always want to challenge me. Well, what's your politics? Are you liberal? I'm like, of course I'm liberal. I'm a comedian. I need people to be relaxed and open and fun, and conservatives aren't. They're a terrible audience. So I just want to start the comedy party. Like, that's all I want, is just vote for the funniest people. Right. The comedians will take care of us.
That's right.
And they don't know how to respond to that, you know, because they've never heard that before. So it gives you that ability to get the criticism in there, the, you know, the actual thought in there without it turning over to cynicism. Because I see a lot of people that I came from the paleo community for a long time, and they're all alternative thinkers, and they think they're libertarians, and, you know, the self-determination bullshit. And I'm like, hey, let me take that apart for you just a little bit. White guy who wants to self-determine because he's 6'3 and weighs 240 and can carry a gun and survive, you know, and just the fact that they've never thought that self-determinism and individualism could potentially be a problem. You know, they've got none of that, none of the alternative stuff creeping in that just gives them a little bit of, slows them down just a little bit on that thought train.
Yeah. So. Yeah, that's good work. That's important.
Yeah, well, I enjoy it. I usually keep it fun because I don't like arguing with that ilk. Like, there's no profit in it. It's like you said, what's the profit in it for me? I need to enjoy it. So, well, I've kept you a long time. I really appreciate this. You're great.
Oh, thank you. You're great.
You're awesome to talk to. You know your stuff. Maybe we can circle back around at some point. I would love to help promote your book. Anything we can do.
Thank you. I would enjoy that. Yeah, I would enjoy chatting.
Okay. And where can people find you if they want your stuff?
My books are sold wherever books are sold. I'm on Twitter. I write in public. I make jokes. They're not funny, or they are, maybe.
I'm not sure they're funny. I'm sure they have funny potential.
Potential. I got potential.
Yeah. Well, I will put your stuff up on the site, and everybody go check out Jennifer Mercia. And I appreciate it again very much. Enjoy College Station. I'll enjoy Austin. Off we'll go. Hey, this has been the Rhetoric Warriors podcast. Get out there and persuade some people, because as always, they probably need it.